Everybody ready?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to start with another 2 minutes of meditation just to bring our, let's all be here. So 2 minutes. And then will you say a prayer for us? One might be quite far along on the path, but if one meets a beginner who sincerely seeks guidance, then one should help without reservation, if this beginner is willing to follow clear-cut directions. If such a beginner were to come to you, what would you say? This is what I said to someone today. The time of beginning is one of the most precious times of all. It can be very exciting and full of wonderful growth. The first thing to do is make up your mind that you're going to go the distance. But commitment needs something else in order to be perpetuated. It needs discipline. This is the perseverance to keep on when things are tough, when the winds of life begin to blow. Adversity is life's way of testing and perfecting and honing and polishing a person and his or her character. Without that, we would never develop character. Rice suffers when it is milled. Jade must suffer when it is polished. But what emerges is something special. If you want to be special too, then you have to be able to stick to things even when they are difficult. Commitment and discipline. These are the two of the most precious words for those who would seek God. There's a concept that I have been working with for the past couple of years, and it has played out so far. I don't care what step an individual's on. If they are committed to the process, they will be safe and protected, regardless of what step. But what happens to newcomers, and some of us that have been around for a while, our commitment begins to waver. Our commitment goes to sex. Our commitment goes to checks. Our commitment goes to the family. Our commitment goes to work. Our commitment goes to our standing in the community. It moves away from God, synonymous with the 12 steps. We are no longer safe and protected when that commitment wavers. Just something I've been observing. I'm just keeping an eye out for it. Those two individuals that I've been sponsoring recently through the steps, they demonstrated their willingness over and over and over by calling me, by completing their assignments on time. When I said, hey, I want you to start calling these individuals to develop a network, they did it. When it was time to make amends, they both catapulted into making amends. They were committed to the process, and as a result, they've been safe and protected. It's also my belief that some individuals just aren't supposed to be safe and protected. They're meant to suffer in that way for whatever reason. I have a whole host of reasons for believing that. And you can ask me later. I don't have time to go into it now. There's a very important concept I want to talk about out of the doctor's opinion. I'm just going to read a small paragraph that I think is vital. Anybody in here suffer from guilt and shame?
Yeah.
Well, after I'm done with this, you will not suffer from it anymore. If you get this concept and you internalize it from an experiential point of view, yes. And if you understand the concept of what it means to be driven. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to drugs and alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers and drug users, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which you and I cannot otherwise account. So, phenomenon of craving. I've sponsored several individuals who have children, who exited their children's lives behind an addiction to drugs, and they're chronic relapsers. I don't know what the hell to call them now. That word does not sit well with me anymore. And they come back to me and they say, Tarek, I can't believe I keep making a choice to pick crack over my kids. And I have to sit down and have a discussion with them around this idea of having a choice. And if you truly understand what the phenomenon of craving really says, it says, the phenomenon of craving says that somewhere between the first and the fifth, because it wasn't always the first one that kicked it off for me. Sometimes it happened between the second and the fifth. I don't know. I can't say it was always with the first one. Because there were times when I did one, and I was able to control. I didn't enjoy much, but I controlled. That was not of me, but it shows up in my experience, so I can't say every single time. But most times I activated a fire inside of me. And here's the deal. That fire burns until it decides to burn out. When the monster wakes up, the monster goes to sleep when the monster wants to go to sleep. So 2005, I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, in the States. I'm on a 5 or 6 day run without sleep. I missed several flights trying to get home. I'm in the midst of the fire. The fire is burning. The monster is alive. And he's on this plane on his way back to Atlanta, and he's trying to figure out how he's going to keep this thing going. Monster gets back to the house with girlfriend in tow. and mom shows up at house. And mom has not seen her son in quite some time. She doesn't even know if I'm alive or dead. Son, monster, proceeds to call his mother words no son should ever call his mother. And proceeds to pick up a dirt devil vacuum cleaner, big handheld one, and throws it at his mother's head as hard as he can. Tarek has a great deal of guilt and shame around that in early recovery. And then it hit me. You mean, literally, now this is going to sound very interesting and may confuse you, when we activate the fire or the monster, we are not responsible for what happens after that. But we can't tell anyone that in a 9-step amends. I can't tell someone in a 9-step amends, hey, I activated the phenomenon of craving, and that's why I called you all those words, and that's why I threw that vacuum cleaner at your head. It doesn't play out like that. My mom wants to hear certain things when I went and made this amends to her. Mom, this is how I harmed you. Would you like to tell me how any of this makes you feel? Did I leave anything out? And what do I have to do to make things right between us? That's it. It's important for me to understand the concept about not being responsible, because the only reason any of us ever have any guilt or shame, and the difference between guilt is when I violate some law that all of us are aware of and you catch me red-handed, I'm guilty. Shame is when I violate some internal moral compass and I am entirely have forbidden myself from violating that moral. And so I suffer a great deal of shame. If you get the concept of phenomenon of craving, you'll know you couldn't have done any different. Okay? I couldn't have done any different. When I sponsor guys and they have guilt and shame around stuff like that, not being in their kids' lives, it's because they think they could have done different. Therefore, they don't understand not having a choice after you start. Literally. All bets are off if you have an abnormal physical reaction. So, let's go a little step further. If you truly get this concept out of your own experience, is it unacceptable to engage in that kind of behavior? I'm not a guy that talks about acceptance. I don't talk about it at all. I talk about unacceptance. Mike's one of the individuals that has taught me about this. It became unacceptable to suffer from lack of power. So I became willing to do whatever I have to do to have access to power. It became unacceptable to be capable of doing that to the people that care about me. As a result of truly seeing, I had a dilemma. Right? Lack of power is only a dilemma when we're facing something we don't want to do anymore. Right? As long as we're still getting something, there is no dilemma. But lack of power became a dilemma for me, and it became unacceptable to be capable of those things. This is the conversation I have around this physical craving. When I'm taking someone through the book very quickly, I focus on that paragraph, and then I look at important engagements that we were all supposed to be at. Sober at work at 9 o'clock is an engagement, right? And for whatever reason, I showed up high to work a lot. That important engagement was not met. Not to mention all the family function and all the other commitments that I was supposed to be at and did not show up to. Quickly. All right, let's rattle off some experiences. Because for years, I was the type of guy that took a person through the big book. I said, well, this is the historical information here. I want you to write this note in your book. I want you to highlight this paragraph. Do you understand? Let's move on. I don't do that anymore. Now I turn the statement into a question. I give them an example from my experience. Now I'm done. They need to bring their memories to bear now, not mine. I can use my experience all day long. Somebody can just sit, rattle off, yes, no, yes. That's that effective. The individuals we take through the steps have to have an experience. That big book has to become about them. It has to be personalized. And the best way to do that is to turn a statement into a question and force the person you're taking through the steps to bring some memories to bear. Don't use my experience. Use your experience. to abundantly confirm to yourself that you're addict and or alcoholic physically. And that's all we're focusing on there. As I take them through, we're going to go into Bill's story, simple identification exercise. I don't read it with them. I give them the assignment, whatever they want to talk about that they highlighted, where they identified with Bill's thinking, feelings, or his drinking. And if they didn't drink, they have to talk about drugs. So when I read the big book to an addict, do you guys actually think I read the word alcohol as we read the book? Uh-uh. The liar inside the individual's head will sit there and say to them, man, this book's about these alcoholics, and they lived 85 years ago, and this guy's in New York, and I'm out from the cut in Georgia. What are you talking about? This makes no sense. So I turn the book. The book is a textbook, so I can use it any way I want to as long as I stay within the framework and the baseline of the big book. And so if I'm working with a heroin addict, we're going to talk about heroin. If I'm working with a cocaine addict, we're going to talk about cocaine. If I'm working with an alcoholic, the book's going to be about alcoholism like it is. But there's no reason to take someone through the book that has no drinking experience and keep using this word alcohol, because when the time comes and they're looking for a reason to be separated, they'll find it right there. They will find it right there. So I give them that exercise, but I always go to this one paragraph. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next day are unforgettable. I think that's like page 6. You know, the courage to do battle was not there. I don't know how many mornings you had like that. I had many, many, many. So I start sharing that experience. And then I want them to share some of theirs. And then the morass, the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match. I was overwhelmed. Crack cocaine was my master. That's a first step paragraph. We need to sit down and have some conversations around that paragraph. The big book's very redundant. The big book tells you what it's going to tell you. It tells it to you, then it tells you what it just told you. We don't need to cover all of that if you want to get someone through the book quickly. We just need to sit down and have some experiential conversations where we're bringing our stories to bear to prove something is abundantly true for us in our experience. And that's what I use Bill's story for. Then we go through the end. But there's a wonderful paragraph that's a checklist for me. This is on page 13. Nope. So Ebby visits Bill. They work the steps. Bill has that experience. He's sitting in his hotel room. He's still going through DTs. He's still on some of the medication. He's gone through some of the steps. He says, if there is a God, show yourself to me. The whole room lights up. A breeze comes in. And Bill, that proves the existence of God. Right? Bill runs around the hospital the next day. Dr. Silkworth's like, I don't know what's... Whatever you have, Bill, is different. But you better hold on to it because it's a hell of a lot better than what you had yesterday. Okay? And so Bill says, he's talking about Ebby's proposals. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. And so I work with a lot of people that have been around for a minute that are going back through the steps, that are struggling. And I always ask them, have you felt electricity run through your life in this process? Have you felt a sense of victory over and over and over in this process? Followed by such a peace and serenity as you had ever known. So I asked them, what levels of peace and serenity have you experienced since you've been here? There was utter confidence. Have you felt that? Have you felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through? Has God come to you? Have you experienced your Creator? It's a checklist. This stuff has to happen. What happened to Bill Wilson is all of it happened in that moment. All of these things have happened to me, a few of them at the same time, but over the course of 10 years, I've experienced every single one of those things. And so, I know Mike and I have been stressing the newcomer, but some of us are going to be put in a position where we're taking people through the steps that have been around for a while and they're dying. They need to have a new experience. And so, same questions, some of them have to be phrased a little differently, but that's how I would use Bill's story. And then, one of Mike's favorite pages, page 18. I'm gonna let Mike tackle that one. But the all the way from page 1 to page 23, they're talking a lot about what happens to us after we drink and the progression of our drinking. So on page 21, we get introduced to the real addict and the real alcoholic. So I make a distinction between an addict and alcoholic with power and an addict and alcoholic without power. On page 21, we meet someone. Page 21 says, what about the real alcoholic or the real addict? He may start off as a moderate drinker and he may become a continuous hard drinker. But for the real one, at some point in his liquor consumption or his drug use, he begins to lose all control of his drug use or liquor consumption once he starts physically. I find my alcoholism right there. I drank for 17 years and I go all the happy hours that I went to. I see loss of control. I had a certain intent when I walked into the bar. My intent was not to get shithoused. I was there to have a few drinks. And over that happened to me. Physically, I'm alcoholic. I don't have to spend a lot of time with drugs. There are a lot of drugs I couldn't control, and I got many years looking at it. But then on page 24, they flip the script. It says, for most of us, not all of us, for reasons we don't understand, have lost the power of choice in drinking drug. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. And these are the three most important words in this paragraph on page 24. At certain times, we can't bring into this consciousness, this mind, with sufficient force, the pain, the memory of the pain, the consequences, the humiliation of a week ago, a month ago, and with certain drugs that we do, it's a few hours ago. We are without defense against the first drink or drug. That's the alcoholic and the addict without any power. You've been stripped of power, choice, and control when you fit the description on page 21. And the description on page 24. When I'm sponsoring a new guy through the process, it's really easy for him to see all bets are off once he starts. A lot of individuals have a really difficult time. They don't have They can't see that they don't have a choice with no drugs and alcohol in their system. They always argue back at me, in that moment, I made a choice to relapse. And I say, I'm sorry, you've misunderstood the entire process up to this point. And so how do we need a really good way of showing them this. And this is a way I've developed. So I used to have this really nice job, corner office. And I would sit in this office and all day long, my friend is knocking. All day long, crack, Mr. Crack. And I'm not answering the door. I don't answer the door. So the word choice implies, would you guys agree with me that the word choice implies an intellectual sorting out process? Yeah? You guys all got dressed this morning and you were looking in whatever clothes you brought with you and you said yes or no. Intellectual sorting out process. You examine your options and you either accept them or reject them. Deny. Footnote. The word deny or denial is only used one time in the big book in the first 164 pages. It's in Bill's story, and it's when it's talking about his dad, and they're talking about God. The only other time it's used is in the spiritual experience appendix. Okay? The denial of God. So, examine options. Accept, reject. All day long, I'm examining options. I'm not spending my paycheck. I got to be at mom's house tomorrow morning. I got to go do this. Not a good idea. I make a choice not to. All day long, not answering the door. Pull out of the parking garage. Drive down to the traffic light. I open the door. Next thing I know, I'm downtown. Next thing you know, 3 days have passed. I'm in a crack house. What happened to my intellectual sorting out process when I hit that traffic light? My willpower became practically unavailable. And how do I know when that time's going to come? And how do I protect myself from that? That's how I teach someone they don't have a choice. At some point, the intellectual sorting out process is unavailable. The flip side is, I don't work the 12 steps, then God gives me the power to make that choice again. First off, I always ask people, I got this from Joe, what kind of God would give you a choice over something that might kill you? Why wouldn't a loving God, an all-powerful God, just remove it the illusion that I had a choice is what's been removed. So this morning, when I woke up at like 6 o'clock, here were my choices. Go out on my patio and watch the sunrise, then pray and meditate. Pray and meditate and still watch the sunrise. I'm going to take a shower, then I'll pray and meditate, and then the sunrise. Option D was not smoke crack or go get a drink. Never shows up on my radar. It's never one of my choices that I go over. It's not there. So when the book, on page 85, the book says, we've been placed in the position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have it even sworn off. The problem has been removed. My problem for years was all those choices, then D. I'm going to get high. Gone. It's gone. And this is the conversation I have around this idea of not having a choice, because once a guy or a gal really sees, holy shit, I don't know what that certain time looks like, they become willing to protect themselves by seeking power. That's the only thing I have found effective in protecting yourself from that.
No, push. You got it. Go.
All right. So, first step, drive it hard. You got to drive it home. The people that we work with have to see that death in the first step. They have to see that dying the alcoholic death or living life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. And the physical death is if you're fortunate. Because I think most of us sitting in this room, if not all of us, know that dying the addict death or the alcoholic death can be a slow, painful, arduous process. So many things die before our body dies. And that's what we're up against here. And I have to show a new person. I have to show a person that's been around for a while. This is what we're up against. You have to die in order to live. But we want to die selfishness. We want self-centeredness to die. Okay? We want egoism to die. Self-importance to die. We don't want to die the spiritual death. And the quickest way to die spiritually is to go through this process and not help somebody. I didn't go through this process so I could drive a nice car. I didn't go through this process so I could swipe my goddamn credit card every day. What I get from this process, a nice car, swiping a credit card, pales in comparison to what I get when I watch somebody transform. When I get to witness that and play a role in that. To watch someone die and be reborn. That's what we're talking about here. The reason we have 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts of service is to carry the message to the addict or alcoholic that still suffers. Right? Not to put on AA dances and CA dances. The conventions are super cool. Right? Doing these things is wonderful. We're taking people, we're bringing people to the message. Work and self-sacrifice for others is how we grow spiritually. The step work is the prep work. It says it in the foreword to the second edition. It says that hard work, strenuous work, one addict with another, one alcoholic with another, is vital for permanent recovery. Does not say one day at a time. The 24 hours are referenced twice in our big book, one on page 16 in Bill's story. Faith must work in us and through us 24 hours a day. And then on page 87, it says we must consider the 24 hours ahead. Not once in our big book does it say, not in the first 164 pages, that we stay clean and sober one miserable day at a time. So the guys that work with me know that they were going to learn how to live their life a day at a time, and they will have permanent recovery as long as they commit to this process. Commit to the process. Die to live. Die self-centeredness. That's the price. That's the price. Brother Mike, go.
When I just closed my eyes, I could see Job saying, this is not a one day at a time deal, this is the rest of my life deal. So that's a phrase, you said something earlier, and I started to slip it in there, and I said, no, I'll just let it go, but you're going to hear a lot of bullshit in the rooms. that don't apply to you. A lot of cliches that they very freely put on the wall and, you know, hang in a lot of clubs and, you know, that don't apply to the real alcoholic and the real addict until he gets some power. I would advise you, until you get some power, not to think. When the thought comes, turn to God. Turn to God. If you need to still discuss it with another, turn to your sponsor and discuss it. I would advise you not to easy do it. They don't mention easy does it in the big book, to way in the back of the book somewhere. If you get here, the deal is you got to the nut house. Y'all do know this is a nut house, right? That means if you made it to the nut house, you just might be a nut. It would probably be to your advantage to find out whether you are or not. The nut is the guy that's in the club, in the club. There's a club in the club here. And we've touched on it throughout this afternoon. Everybody's not in the club, in the club. But you better find out if you are or not. So it's just certain things that, for me, that don't apply to my recovery. There's a jumping off point that has to happen, right? There's some information and some facts, right? The book says we alcoholics and addicts are stickler for facts and results. I need to find out what the facts are in my life. Do I have control after I take one? That's a fact. When I get distance between me and my buddy, does my buddy come looking for me and I go? Willingly at times and unwillingly at times. That's a fact. Very simple deal. With no drugs or no alcohol in my system, can I fix me when life shows up? Very simple facts. If those three things are true for you, you're probably in the club, in the club. That means there's some stuff that you're going to have to do for the rest of your life. You don't have an option. There is no maybes. Every time I come here, I get hit with the deal of they take siestas here. So we were walking around the other day, and it was siesta time. What is it, 2 to 5 or something? Something like that, yeah. And the store shut down. Well, you don't get siestas in recovery. You don't get time off. This is a 24/7 thing. No vacations. So just some pertinent stuff for the real guy, that guy, moderate, hard, real alcoholic, real addict, that don't apply to the other two. It applies to the real one, that's it. And as a result of getting in touch with that, and then claiming that as my truth, I begin to get some freedom to live. And it's phenomenal. And you look up one day and your life is completely transformed. And a lot of times when that transformation takes place, you don't even know. Somebody will point it out to you and say, something different about you. You know, or you look different. Or look at you, man, you look great. What you doing? And you won't even have tapped into the transformation that's taken place within you. All you will have done is applied yourself to a process, a 12-step path, abandon yourself to an individual that you trust completely, a sponsor, book never talks about a sponsor, though. Never uses the word. But it does talk about a person properly armed with facts about themselves that can gain your confidence. Someone that you can share you with and you trust you with. And watch what happens to your life. We're going to push it.
A few years ago, it's been several years now, I was listening to a talk Mike gave, and I connected it with unmanageability and when we're crushed by self-imposed crises that we cannot postpone or evade, and those defects begin to thrust themselves into our lives and all our shortcomings, we begin to experience what I call a burning, a friction in our lives, and it gets really dark. It's about intent at this point. I know when I experience a dark night of the soul in my recovery, in my life on this path, that I'm about to move from one station to the next. A lot of scripture talks about this. The dark night descends on a soul only when all other things have failed. When you are no longer the best meditator in the class because your meditation produces absolutely nothing. When prayer evaporates on your tongue and you have nothing left to say to God. When you are not even tempted to return to a life of worldly pleasure because the world has proven empty. And yet taking another step taking another step through the void of the spiritual life feels futile because you are no good at it and it seems as if God has given up on you. You can scarcely conjure up your old passion for God. It has become clear that you're unable to do anything on your own to remedy your spiritual brokenness. The rooms of AA will see us do some goofy and insane stuff. But I'm here to tell you, if you're experiencing that and then you happen to act out in some goofy and insane stuff and your intent is that the struggle that you're moving through is sacred and it's merciful because it ain't drugs and alcohol that's doing it, and it's there and it's got some, it's rooted in grace. We can go through these spiritual experiences through our character, the struggle that can be generated through shortcomings. It's a much better path than what crack cocaine and heroin and crystal meth and alcohol did. If the intent is set for spiritual evolution. So when the dark night descends and it comes for all of us, the big book calls it trials and low spots. This is, if this leads to God and we're committed and we're safe and protected, these experiences that I've been through in my recovery, I'm going to talk about it tomorrow, have led to some of the most sincere prayer life that I have ever experienced. So how can you not be in fit spiritual? Because if we attach fit spiritual condition to all the behavior, what happens when you act out? And I'm not giving you a green light to act out, but the deal is we're all going to fall short. We're all going to do goofy stuff in recovery. I promise you. If we're doing the goofy and we turn to God, and we constantly are turning to God, and we're constantly turning to our teachers and our closed-mouthed friends, and we're asking them, how did you make it through this? And when we turn back into the spiritual process, how can you not be in fit spiritual condition? So this left me a few years ago, this idea that fit spiritual condition has specific behavior attached to it. Bullshit. Fit spiritual conditions about that line in the back of the book I was talking about in the first session. The essence of spiritual experience, the essence, the central point is the awareness of a power greater than myself. The awareness that God is in all the goofy shit. God's everything or else he's nothing. I'm a second step proposition guy. I don't talk about the self-will thing a lot. Because here's the deal. 10 years ago, you seen me active on a crack run. Oh, that boy's self will run riot. 10 years later, you look back at that crack run, you go, that's God leading me down to my surrender. How do you separate self will from God's will? They're one and the same in my book. The idea that I can just make a choice to disconnect from God, that's just ludicrous to me. The human mind, this egoic mind, it's what blocks me. I'm no closer to God now than I was 10 years ago with a crack pipe in my mouth. The only difference is my awareness. That's what's different. And you can go through all the goofy, insane behavior in recovery, which we're all going to. Are we aware of God in the middle of all of it? And then we can move through a dark night of the soul, crushed by a self-imposed crisis that we cannot postpone or obey. We have to fearlessly face the proposition: God's everything or else he's nothing. That shit is a concept until you're crushed. Right? You just talk about it in meetings. Until you're crushed. And then you're going to stand at the turning point. And then what is your choice to be? It's completely different when life brings it to you. And life and God are synonyms in my book. You know, God, the word God works, but it's limited. Because as soon as I say God is this, he is not that. That's why God is everything and he is nothing in my book. So, Mr. Mike.
Spiritual growth. Spiritual evolution. I think I believe, based on my experience, is that when I take the material that's given to me, and I begin to really connect with it and apply it to my life. For instance, there's two guys, Joe and Charlie, got some CDs, Big Book Comes Alive, right? So I don't really know what they do, I just know the phrase, right? So for me, the Big Book Comes Alive when I begin to really connect with what they talk about in here. That my troubles are of my own making. That selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of my problem. God either is or he isn't. God can and will for me. And I begin to experience these things in my life, and what happens as a result of buying in, I begin to have an experience with this God idea. And as a result of having initial experiences based on my daily life walk and God showing up, I become willing to believe. That moves from willing to believe to believing. That moves from believing to faith. Then moves into a place of knowing that God is and cultivating a personal relationship with him. So the light bulb is on and it gets brighter and brighter. And I read stuff like See What Religious People Are About. So I tap into that avenue and I see that they got some books that talk about specific stuff. Begin to talk about meditation and prayer. Begin to talk about, check religion out. See what everybody in churches ain't hypocrites. And I begin to form this idea and this theory of God that becomes a reality that I become more and more willing to grow with. Because my life begins to change on a number of levels. And they begin to change on a number of levels because I begin to tap into that nothing in this sphere of existence, meaning physical, earth, man, material, had anything to do with it. Anybody ever had an experience like that? Where something's happened in your life and you've said, couldn't nothing but a God have done that? Something out of the ordinary, somebody's going to think this is spooky, but I'm going to say it anyway. Supernatural. For me, supernatural is no more than spiritual. My God is supernatural and spiritual. Miracle worker, he's a wizard. He's all-knowing. He's unending. And the longer you do this, the longer you get into the mindset and the knowingness that there is no name or set of deals that you can put on this God idea. Because every time you try to do it, he just busts wide open. And you begin to tap into the nuts and bolts of what we do here. Second step for me is the most powerful step, because I begin a quest of aligning myself with a power greater than myself, that initially I became willing to believe that if I did that, I wouldn't shoot dope no more. But then as a result of that, I found out that shooting dope is this much of the problem. I begin to tap into the reality that my thinker is broke. I have a warped, decayed mind. It stopped working years ago. It needs to be fixed. So I begin to turn to the fixer. And I abandon the idea that I'm the fixer. That's what got me here. I'm the fixer. I can fix it. And something miraculous just happens out of nowhere. Like, the obsession is removed. You get a number of months under your belt. You get a year under your belt. You don't even realize it. Your thoughts have left that plane. You remember going to New York and in my first set of amends and coming back and saying to my sponsor, man, I went on the avenue and they wanted me to get high and they offered me this and offered me that, and I think it was like 2 years clean. I said, and I didn't get loaded. I didn't accept none of it. And I was just jolly and gay and jubal and all that, and he looked at me with a straight face, straight in the eye, and said, I bet you think you had something to do with that. The light bulb lit up a little bit brighter. Why? Because I always got loaded. I don't care what you had. Even if what you had I didn't really like, I'd do it anyway. The beginning of heroin to the end of heroin, when I put alcohol down, if you had a drink, I'd drink with you. But I didn't really like alcohol at that point. So there's a process, there's a miracle of healing here that gets me willing to buy in. And remember again who we're talking to. When I do my deal, I come to talk to a very specific person. That's that real guy. That's that guy that hopefully by the time you've gotten to us, this is the last house on the block for you. Nothing's worked. You've tried to stay stopped umpteen times. You probably don't even know it's about staying stopped. You think probably it's about, let me just stop, I'll be okay. Never entertain that idea in 20-something years of using. Multiple treatment programs, methadone maintenance, outpatient, drug geographics, all that. Never tapped in to the very simple idea, this is about staying stopped. Until I got to this book. Mm. And until I got to a guy that knew it was about staying stopped. So very powerful step. In step one, you're looking at death. In step two, you're looking at living. You're looking at, man, you actually mean I can breathe? I can take a breath now? That death is not a cannot be an option. It's still on the table, but it don't have to be an option today. You don't have to die. If you're like me, in last treatment program, 1987, I went in there knowing at 37, knowing by 40 I'd be dead. Because my brother OD'd and died at 41. Ran twice as hard as he did. Knew I'd be dead. Didn't go in there because I wanted to stop using everything. Kind of thought I'd smoke reefer for the rest of my life. Sniff a little cocaine, it's okay. Lifestyle. All got smashed. As a result of being there, hearing the message, getting out, getting a sponsor who was properly armed with some facts, that had a solution, that had some depth and some weight. The language used in this book held my attention, caught my attention, and held my attention. Became willing to follow directions. I'm not a suggestion guy. I'm a directions guy. My spiritual guides gave me directions, said, do this. They didn't suggest I do anything. And something happened. What happened was I got free. I believe the same freedom that I wanted when I took my first drink at the age of 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. Same freedom I was looking for then. Finally got it. Some 30 years later. 20-something years later. So there's a proven path here with some qualified, bona fide individuals to help guide you down it. I'll say it. Everybody in the room ain't qualified. Everybody in the room ain't qualified to be a sponsor. If you got a sponsor and you're not getting the results you think you should be getting, might be a sign for you to get another sponsor. For me, a sponsor is designed to do one thing. Put you on a path to God. That's it. Ain't about me being your buddy and your bank and your relationship therapist and all that stuff. The agenda is to get you to God as quickly as I can. Because you're dying.
The first layer of healing that any of us experience comes through the fellowship on some level. I'm sitting in a meeting, I hear someone tell a part of my story, and the sense of separation and isolation falls away. I realize I'm not the only one that's had that experience. But that by itself would not have held us together as we are now joined. There's a deeper level of healing. I want to know what's going on with that dark night of the soul, the current unmanageability. When I'm easily annoyed by anything and anyone, when I feel this, I get this idea that I'm never going to be satisfied, that I just am uneasy the majority of the time. What's been your experience with moving through that? And then I hear that, and that's done through the step process. That's done by placing ourselves on a path to God, that I begin to heal on that level. And then I start comparing notes with people, and I continue to compare notes because that stuff comes and goes. That's the healing process. The fellowship by itself is like a warm bath. It doesn't last for long. Not for the real addict and the real alcoholic. The deal is, though, there was a part of me that was very confrontational for many years. I almost would tell these people they weren't fucking welcome. I wouldn't say that to them, but I would share in such a way that they didn't feel welcomed anymore. I don't do that anymore. I don't want to be a separator anymore. Everyone is necessary. Nothing in the Creator's universe happens without Him creating it. They're all necessary. I just, you know, but they're not all qualified to be sponsors. And that's why it's so important to have someone take you through so you can discover your truth. Because if you're a mad dog for heroin or cocaine or meth, you want to consider being a mad dog for these 12 steps in God. And you want to stay thirsty for it. And you want to stay hungry for it. You know, as I'm taking a guy into the second step, I start to do you guys, anyone honestly believe alcohol and drugs would have done so much to us if at one point in the past they granted us access to a huge amount of power? I don't know about you guys, but the first time I felt the magic of cocaine and whiskey, huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. Ideas, attitudes, and emotions which had been guiding me to that point, so completely cast aside. New set of motives and conceptions began to dominate me. That's what cocaine and whiskey did when they were working. And so I start to ask an individual, and especially new guys, when alcohol and drugs were working, what'd they give you? Confidence. They took the fear away. They gave me a present moment. Like, I didn't care about what my troubles were. I didn't care about tomorrow. I didn't care about how I fucked up yesterday. I would. The most majestic plans in the world were designed while I was high as hell. I was going to dig myself out of every problem. I had courage. I felt electric. Okay, so we're working with a new conception. Can your new conception provide that for you? Because if it can't, we're in trouble. The same sense of ease and comfort that we found by taking a few drinks and a few drugs has to be found in this 12-step process. I'm a guy that believes that you don't have to have a conception of God for the power of God to start working in your life. It's impossible for us to fully define and comprehend that which is God. But we need a starting place, however inadequate. We need to start somewhere, and we need to move. And thank God for the teachers I've had, this man and a few others who have kept me fluid in my conceptions of God, man. Like the last 3 or 4 years, it's pretty much been very consistent. But I mean, they left me free to investigate, to have fun with it, and to completely scratch the shit I grew up with. If I were to hop on an elevator and someone asked me what religion I follow, I would tell them Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, and they're going to look at me and say, "You're very confused." I'm going to say, "No, I'm not. I'm very free. Because I look for truth in all of it. I look for the truth in all of it." That second step is magical. You know, the funny thing is, Mike took me through a piece of work about 3 years ago, and the second step spoke to me because I saw the link between self-will, quote-unquote, whatever self-will run riot is, versus unmanageability. It all hinged. It's like a seesaw. And the pin in the seesaw is the second step. You know, when I looked at my current manifestations of how I was the director trying to be the producer and the light guy and the sound guy and all of that, and then I looked at the current existence of the bedevilments in my life, and then what connected all that was all the negative, doubtful, and unproductive ideas I had about my creator. It just went back and forth. I was stuck. You know, I get that step one gives me the willingness, because I see the connection to all of that to my addict. But step two is what creates all that stuff in my life. God creates it through that experience. God's tapping me on the shoulder. I'll continue to show up. Acknowledge my presence. Acknowledge my presence. So we can have some fun with these steps. I mean, the pages in the big book are 500 feet deep. They literally are. So much can be done here. It doesn't have to be routine. It does not have to be mechanical. It can be exciting. But the spiritual path is not always about unicorns and rainbows. I will tell you that right now. For me, in my experience, and the experience of countless others, it does an immense amount of struggle and darkness is on that path. It's not for the faint of heart. You'll stand at the turning point like me many times. Turning points are always rooted in genuine surrender. Third step being one of them.
Third step really being a jumping off point. The jumping off point to the beginning of what? Surrender. And if you're not aligned with the conception of God that you're willing to believe in, that's the hook in the second step. Willing to believe. Because we bring ideas of God to the second step that stifle us and get us, was that when you get stuck? Just get stuck. You can't move. And a lot of times it has to do with a lot of the of God ideas that you grow up with, attached to certain religions. And as a result of that, and the result you live, the way you've lived your life, you're not willing to turn your life and your will over to this God that you know no good is going to come out of it. Why would he do anything for you? So free in the second step. Free from all those attachments that we've had all our lives. It's a book by Don Ruiz called Five Levels of Attachment. It's about detachment. And based on what I've seen in one and two, I know it becomes necessary for the acquisition of power. If I'm to live. And there's a part of me from the very beginning that wanted to live. When I took that first sip of wine, it was an effort to live. When I hit that joint for the first time, it was an effort to live. So I've been wanting to live for a very long time. I just didn't know how. But now I get involved in a process surrounded by a group of people that have got some results based on some facts about themselves individually. And I become willing to believe that if it worked for them, it can work for me. They ain't no better than me. And I take the plunge. Why? Why not? I'm gonna die anyway. If something don't happen, I'm going to die anyway. So I take the plunge. I make the decision. And the decision on 62 is very simple. I'm going to stop playing God. I'm going to quit playing God based on a very, very simple deduction. It don't work. For one thing, it got me sitting in Cocaine Anonymous. The Nut House. That's one thing. The second thing is that I got another bunch of nuts sitting around me. So why not join together in a common goal? 17 talks about the camaraderie. We band together. We take it even deeper. Like-minded people, we band together. And we start a journey together as a result of turning our life and our will over to the care of God. And again, something happens that's unexplainable. Why is it unexplainable? Because so many people didn't make it. Why me? Why me? Another break?
So run it out for a minute.
Huh?
Do you guys mind if we go for maybe 20 more? Or do you guys want a break? 20, it's 4:15. We figure we'll wrap up at 4:45 and be done with it. Does that sound too long? We've been running. Yeah, that would put us at like an hour and 25 minutes if we keep going.
Group conscience. All in favor? Another...
What are we voting on?
15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, 15, 20 minutes.
All in favor? Yeah. Raise them high.
Yeah. All right, we're good.
All opposed?
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to share some practices I do with new people and people that have been around for a while around this four step. The let's say someone comes to me and I give them an assignment. I say, I want you to put a timer on for 30 minutes. I want you to ask God to show you the truth about what's blocking you from being aware of His presence in your life. And whatever's done on that paper in 30 minutes, that's all there is. And so they come to me and say, I've got 60 resentments. I said, okay, here we go. You're only going to write on 25 of them. You get to pick them. 25, that's it. You ain't going to write on all 60. And then I give them the assignments for the first, second, third, and fourth column. And some guys write all four at the same time. Some guys I'll have them do two and three all the way through, then come back and do four. Just I don't know how it plays out in each situation. But they only do people and institutions. And then they start their fifth step with me. Look, I've done so many fifth steps, I got tired of 8 and 9 hour fifth steps. I couldn't do it anymore. I don't like spending more than 3 hours with a newcomer because I don't want to expose myself to that toxic level of energy for more than 3 hours at a time. It was starting to affect me. I work in this industry. I own a recovery center, and I sage myself on a regular basis when I get home because I am dipped in that environment, and your environment has an effect on you. And so we begin the fifth step. For me, I want to stay engaged in the fifth step, so I make three lists while I'm listening to a fifth step. The first one's going to be a list of the fears that come out of that fourth column. The second list is called aspects of character or self-defeating principles and belief systems. And then I make an eight-step list for them. I don't make their eight-step list, but I highly suggest you talk to God about making this amends. This is how I do it. And as I'm listening to their fifth step, I'm making a list of the principal inventory they're going to do. And when they're done there, I give them their principal inventory. And principal inventory's got different four columns. And here's the principal. Well, where'd you get this idea? Okay, that's the first thing I want to know. Where'd this idea begin? And then I want to know, when you're operating by this code, value, or principle, how do you interact with other people? And then we're going to answer the questions in column three. Self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, sex relations, personal relations, and pocketbook. That's how I do principal inventory. I've already given them their fear, so when they're done there, they do their fear. I do a three-column fear inventory. The fear, why do you have this fear? And when you're driven by this fear, how do you show up in relationship to other people? Because I'm going to tell you guys, the longer I stay clean and sober, my spirituality, my awareness of God does not depend on how many people I'm sponsoring, does not depend on prayer and meditation, does not depend on how many meetings I'm going to. It depends on the relationships in my life and how they work. Because if every one of you is a manifestation of God and a creation of God, if I'm shut off from you, I'm shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and I'm sideways with 5 or 10 people in my life, yeah, something's way off. That's my spiritual condition barometer. What do the relationships at home look like? What do the relationships at work look like? What do the relationship at the home groups look like? What do the relationship with my friends look like? That's it. That's how I measure fit spiritual. It just happens that for all that stuff to look really solid sometimes, it's like by default you're just doing the other things. But there have been periods in my life where I have been mechanically and routinely doing prayer and meditation, sponsoring people, and accountability is not what it should be. And if I look at some relationships, I've got trouble in personal relationships. A lot of judgment and stress. That tells me something's off. I'm not walking around consciously thinking about God. It's not like I walk around all day consciously thinking about God, but that's the ideal that I want to grow towards. That's what I base my spirituality on. Can I look into your eyes? And whatever is peering out from behind your eyes is the same thing that's peering out from behind my eyes. Can I be conscious of that? That the God in me is looking at the God in you. You can, what's a spiritual, if you want to get present in a conversation with somebody, work with that. Work with that. And so that's how I do fifth steps. 6 and 7, I want to share this with you guys. So I'm moving through a phase in my development where sincerity in my prayer life is very important to me right now. And so I came up with this exercise a few years ago So I listened to a fifth step. This guy gets his list. He goes to home. He does his hour returning home. And then for the next period of time, it's indefinite, he has a 3x5 card with all his defects and limiting belief systems and aspects of character that he sits with in the morning in his prayer and meditation. And on the either the back of that card or another card, he writes his own seven-step prayer. He can use the one in the big book. I'm indifferent. But I tell him, I'm like, look, you're not taking your seventh step until you're summoned by God. And they'll always say, what do you mean I'm going to be summoned by God? Here's the deal. You're going to be walking through your week. You're going to be walking through your day. And you're going to be crushed by a self-imposed crisis you can't postpone or evade based on one of these defects. One of these defects and these principles that you live by is going to become active. And it's going to wreck you. It's going to eat your lunch. When it happens, I immediately want you to go somewhere private and drop to your knees and do your seventh step. There is something powerful and meaningful when you do the seventh step out of sincerity. Instead of just the mechanical way that I did it for years. Oh, I've done my inventory. I've done my fifth step. Time to do a six and seven. I do it. Maybe sometimes I do some ceremony for it. But I'm telling you, when you're in the middle of it, and then you're dropping to your knees, it changes the game. Okay, so do with that what you will. And then we start, you know, we make our note cards for amends, and we've gone through these first nine steps, and we have launched the launching pad into the world of the Spirit. That's what these first nine steps are. But we don't get to live in the spiritual dimensions of 10, 11, and 12 at optimal capacity if we got a bunch of unfinished amends. And I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, but it took me 8.5 years to make 230 amends. Okay? I'm a guy that made all my fucking amends, and I talk about it. Because they don't talk about that where I'm from. There isn't a human being on this earth that's going to walk towards me down any street and make me cross the street because I don't want to see them. I am free. And it took 8.5 years to get free. And I've paid back $17,000. I got more to pay back. But the approaches have all been made. Now, of those 230, I'd say close to 50 wanted nothing to do with me. They're like, no, we're good. My favorite answer was, we can't believe you still think about that shit. That was my favorite answer when they throw something back at me, why they didn't want to meet. And so the last thing I'm going to share, I'm going to turn it over to Mike so he can wrap it up. You know, in the esoteric traditions of religions, an esoteric is it's only accessed by a select few. In the esoteric tradition, they talk about different degrees of faith. And in one tradition, they equate the divine truth and the faith in the divine truth to fire. And they say there's 3 degrees of it. And I'm gonna relate this to sponsorship and on the part of the sponsor. The first degree is what they call the lore of certainty. So you get to experience the divine truth, the fire, by listening to people tell stories about it. So you hear it secondhand. The next degree they call the eye of certainty. And these individuals actually see the flame. They see the divine truth. They see it, but they don't have real access to it. And then the third degree is called the truth of certainty. That's only experienced by being burned by the flame, the divine truth. When you watch someone else wake up, when you watch their spirit wake up as you're taking them through these 12 steps, you will see the fire. You will be burned and engulfed in the flame. And you'll become so addicted to it that it will be the catalyst for your own spiritual growth, and you'll want it. And there'll be a need for it over and over and over. So what I encourage you to do is get burned in the flame. Be consumed by the flame. That's what's available here. It's not about feeling good. It's not about just not drinking and just not using and going to meetings. There's so much more available here. So much more. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Terry.
Knock us out.
I think Terry said it all. I basically just sat in. It was his deal. And the committee asked me to be a part of it, but I said to him, it's your deal, you take the lead. I'm going to have very little to say. And I've been doing this for so long, and it's time for some others to step up. We need to pass the torch. So I think he did an excellent job. Again, it was an honor to share the podium with you. And like I said, he said it all. I don't have anything else to say, especially since I got to speak later. So thank you guys for coming out.
Let's thank you. Break.
If you guys, if anybody's got any questions or anything they want to ask us after it's over, you can. But meanwhile, let's make a circle and say the Serenity Prayer. Pray out.
Claire, you want to leave us out? Mm-hmm.